Hi everyone, welcome to the Modern Web Podcast. I'm your host, Ray Sean. Today we're joined by Benoit Marchand and Andy Matuszek to discuss reusable components and building them using web technologies. Benoit, would you like to introduce yourself?
Sure, my pleasure. My name is Benoit Marchand, and I've done quite a bit of work on the web since 2000, and I've started building components and framework to do components back in 2006. I've done a couple of frameworks, one at Apple inside that never left, and a new one out called Montage. And Montage is entirely based on components. So that's, I guess that's why I'm here.
Cool.
All right. And I'm Andy Matuszek, and I have been building things on I guess, both web and native for a while. Cocoa since 2001, and I guess dynamic web stuff since 2003 or so. I was at Apple for a while on the UIKit team, where I was very concerned with making modular components. Since then, I've joined Khan Academy, where I've worked with a whole lot of folks using React, and so I got that side of things. Right now, I co-direct a research group for Khan Academy looking at inventing new kinds of learning technology.
Great, and thanks for all you guys do at Khan Academy. I think it's given a lot of people a lot of knowledge for free or close to free, so it's very meaningful.
It's very rewarding.
Yeah. Cool. Let's start off by talking about components. Let's have you guys each describe what you think of when people say components. Benoit, what do you think about components? What are they?
So my first encounter with component was with web objects components. That's where I discovered the term. And web objects component were, I mean, they were an object initially in Objective-C and following up in Java that would load a template that would live into a folder that had a WO extension. And in that folder, you would find an HTML file and a declaration file. And so that declaration file was basically containing the details of web objects tags that would you would find in a markup, and instantiating these objects automatically for you. So a very declarative approach, and one that was orthogonal to the markup in a similar way you could think of as CSS. So you would have these declarations associated with some markup to make them do something, the same way you would associate CSS with a markup to make the looks in a certain way. And this works really well. And I believe the story behind that was that the people at Next who created WebObjects all did AppKit and Cocoa, I mean, Cocoa and Sisters first. And so there was a lot of I mean, it was you could see the affiliation between what you would find in nib with serialized objects, like following through being these kind of declarations. And there was an application called WooBuilder that would actually help you build your UI and create these components visually and serialize them as such. And so when I started to want to have a very strong toolkit to make great application period, but with web technologies, I wanted that. I mean, I've had used that thing very effectively. It made me useful. But there was one thing that wasn't done well. The assets were not encapsulated. So if your components were using images and stuff like that, they were in the classic Cocoa structure, English.lpos, all that stuff. They were not inside the components. And to me, that was an issue. The other thing I wanted to solve was the incompleteness of the templates, and that came from observing how the front end developer I was working with on his back end WebObjects application how much they were struggling to have to run the whole backend application, navigate through that page that they actually had it to work on every time. That's painful. and maintaining the whole code base just for them to do their work on their local machine was challenging. And so when I was looking at building that thing on the client side, I saw an opportunity to ease, and that's one of the whole thread behind Montage as well, but so find a way to stick to components, to have a place, but build it in a way where the HTML CSS developer would have an easier time using the regular standard technologies they know without having to learn anything new, really. And that, to me, that includes not template string language either, because you actually don't need that. And so the result is, and that's how it's been in my Bose framework, because that's so on, and it's been that way for a while, where you have now in Montage, inside the same folder as the .real extension stuff .wood, but you have a complete valid HTML5 document. And the goal is that you can have an HTML CSS developer build that page by itself with almost no logic, just making the way it should look. And then you have a similar serialization of object that comes in that brings the JavaScript imperative part of the component that's going to own an element, and then it's going to own that thing, and it's going to do whatever you want with it, whatever that logic of that component is meant to be, whether it's going to track events, modify the DOM internally, whatever, right? So to me, it's really the encapsulation is very important. Respecting the layers of the web and the separation of concerns, which is not a fancy and pedantic term, it is there in order to make the most of people's talents and know-how. One of my frustrations with JavaScript frameworks in general, and I describe personally Montage as an HTML5 framework for that reason, not a JavaScript framework, because I don't like the fact that most JavaScript developers who create framework, of course they do, they build it from themselves. And most of these guys are multi-talented, and they can do HTML and they can do CSS as well. And so guess what? They find convenient to put everything in the same file. But that's only working for them. And they are not the majority. And that doesn't scale to an ecosystem as big as the web. So encapsulation, very, very important. And it's also a different take on the classic Vue hierarchy system in the classic native environment. The relationship tends to be different. To me, a component can be used, and it's really a matter of architecture where they fit, but you can build a component to be a slider, right, like a bare widget, or you can build a component that's going to represent a whole panel of your app. And really anything in between. They tend to be used differently. So if you use a widget, you're going to have a lot of event handling, user management, user interaction, stuff like that. But if you, and probably lighter on the data side, but it still has the component still has that kind of role of controller in the MVC sense, right? The rendering on the web, to me, the view is the DOM itself. That's it. I mean, it is the whole rendering system. Whether you like it or not, we can't escape that. Whether it's canvas with 2D bitmap or SVG for vector graphic or 3D with WebGL or the pure DOM for most of the stuff. That's the viewing system, right? And so the component is here to kind of like act as that glue that put all this stuff together. And the false promise of, I think, stuff like CSS framework is that you can't make a CSS framework the same way you can't make a JavaScript framework, because at some point they're going to need the other layers. And it's really hard. It's, I mean, I wish it would be possible, but I've never seen anyone managing to build something to end up building app or visible of users in the browser by focusing only on one of these layers, because they have to interact so much. So if you use your component for more of an app structure role, then he's likely going to have a much more MVC role, where his role is going to be to get data and stuff like that. But he's most likely going to delegate the rendering to child components that you're going to instantiate to inject strings, to manage the conditionality of something being visible or not. Widgets, of course, stuff like that. So depending on where you use it into your tree that the NAP is, right? They all are a tree at some point. They're gonna lend themselves to one role or another. But it's kind of great, I think, that they can do this without actually much forking in terms of API. I mean, as far as Montage goes, we've found that there's a lot in common, which means that you have components that do a bunch of stuff that end up being suitable for whether you use them in a way or the other.
Andy, what do you think of?
That's a really insightful answer. I mean, there's a lot there to dig into, but I almost think it's more interesting to zoom out. You know, there's so much insight in your response, so directed at the question of what does it mean to be a component on the web, particularly because component, like with the capital C, has a great deal of meaning for the web already. That word is loaded. It's associated with.
Unfortunately, yes.
Well, it has all these associations with you know, W3 proposals of varying degrees of success. I think it's interesting to zoom out and talk about, you know, okay, what is a component from just a broader perspective of software architecture? What does it mean to be a component? And then we can zoom back in and talk about, like, well, what does that mean for like a web thing and a front end UI? And if we're talking about a component more broadly, I guess I would think about that in terms of there's a broad nebula of responsibilities floating, and a component is an attempt to draw some line around some part of that nebula, prioritizing perhaps cohesion or isolation or safety or control or composition or the closure property or any number of other properties depending on one's desires. There's always going to be trade-offs there. So for instance, one way of looking at components is very focused on modularity, and you focused on that a great deal. Maybe we want to be able to make a slider that's reusable in many cases. But another interesting way to think about components is to think about the component that really you're only going to use in one place, but you're drawing that line because you want there to be a line. You want there to be this boundary, and you want to be very careful and specific about what's crossing the boundary. So one thing that I've kind of cocked my head sideways
that's
at
right.
with these web proposals is they seem to take this very general term, component, that is about software architecture, and seem to make it something really fairly specific. And I guess my question for you is how you think about the difference between these components, these, I don't know, we might call them web components that are very much about like pieces of the front end UI. How exactly do those things differ, and how should they differ from just other group sets of responsibilities in your app using component in a more classical sense?
What do you mean by component in the classical sense?
Component in the sense of this is a set of responsibilities that you've chosen to group into the same module, say, using module as a synonym for component.
So, I mean, reuse is a... before we go there, maybe we should mention that, I mean, as far as I know, I've never encountered the notion of component in native frameworks like Cocoa or .NET.
I think a class is a component. Or do you think of it as something different?
Yes, I do. I think the closest I would describe to a component in Cocoa would be an NS bundle.
That's interesting. I think you have a much more specific conception of that word than I do. That's very interesting.
Because when you load a bundle, right? I mean, an NS bundle in the sense that it contains one main class, it contains one or more nibs, which could be localized, and it contains the assets as well. And that is...
Why is it necessary that it contains a nib or assets? Like, why does that have anything to do with its componentness?
Because the component is about UI. A class can do anything.
Oh.
Right?
Why is a component about UI? And that's ultimately what I'm asking here. Like, why should we specialize this kind of grouping, this kind of abstraction? Why should we privilege it?
Because, like you said, I think the other layers have units. A class is a unit. A module, in terms of packaging, is a unit of code. And they have or not a relationship with any something visual. It doesn't matter. They are their own thing already. They already have names for that. And so I don't know why you would. I mean, every component that I have found, beside the one I created myself, were all about UI. So I guess that's why I assume that. I mean, that's been the most frequent usage of it associated with that.
Well, we can use the term in that way for the course of this conversation. Your response that that these other things, they already have names, is I suppose a reasonable response. So I guess one thing that does seem to be a pervasive issue in these kinds of structures is that, as you say, everything is ultimately a tree. There's a tree of components. Parallel with this tree of components is often another tree structure, some kind of superstructure, perhaps a set of controllers wrapping the controllers. That's not exactly a component. It's not exactly about UI as strongly in the same way. There might be a hierarchical structure of data layers, for instance, and that hierarchical structure might map in some way, loosely or not, to the component structure. What is the responsibility or the appropriate alignment of the component structure, which we've restricted for this conversation to being about UI elements, and these related hierarchical structures?
They're not. I mean, in my experience, they are entirely orthogonal. And so if you take like business objects, if you model them properly with relationships, inverse relationship, I mean, if you go in that line of in that path, they are represented more like a graph more than really a tree, right? Because you have cycles and all that stuff. And they get injected kind of sideways at different points of the component tree, right? There's no good answer. You can have, depending on the apps, you could have a piece of the app that is totally self-contained, like a mini app into an app, and you could have his own connection to somewhere and getting his own data. And then you could have somewhere else, like a very hierarchical structure that get data to the top and that literally like trickle down a tree, each layer of components exposing details of a certain object derived from the root one, right? But then how you get these objects also vary from just each component may do his own XMLHTTP request or have a raw socket connection to themselves, which is kind of crude, but for simple stuff it just works fine. Up to a more data layer like core data. I mean, in Montage we started and are using a version of Montage data that kind of goes in the same direction. But where you may have more capabilities and more abstraction to help you worry less about the gory details of what's happening down there. But that thing is almost, like I said, it's orthogonal. That data layers like that have then their own internal architecture, which is entirely like void of any knowledge, for thank God, of the component on top. I mean, the truth is, it's such a data layer is as useful on the back end as it might be on the client side, right?
Sure.
So they have. I mean, they should be separate because you may want to use them not necessarily with each other all the time. So I think.
How does this injection work in your mind? If these components are independent and say there's some shared data controller between these components, how should that happen?
I don't have a good answer. It really depends on. I mean, we're talking very fancy stuff here. I mean, in terms of tools you choose to use for yourself, first of all. But these tools should have absolutely one benefit, which is they have to simplify your life. If they are not, then you should not be using them, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
But so sticking to simple stuff, what we've tried to do is what we try to do with Montage Data is make a convention that inside one app, you're going to have one data service. That's the starting point. And every query you're going to do, they're going to go to that. Now, if you want to be more sophisticated, and we haven't done that yet, but EOF and Core Data do this, you can, if you need a pocket of like a mini sandbox in your app, and a model...
A child context.
Exactly, a child context. So a model edition of an object that you don't want to bleed everywhere else until you're really, really ready.
Yeah.
It was designed for that, right? So you basically create a nested one, and you've basically fetched your object and all its subgraph again into that small thing. And then these are really copies. So you have two versions of these objects, one in the main and one to nested. So what happens is the nested is only true until you save changes in the nested, and they end up being into the main one or straight back to the to a backend, right? So I mean, this is more advanced, but for most applications, having one is pretty is the best number, right? You can't do without zero, and more might be too complicated to help people understand that. And after that, I mean, that should be sufficient for most stuff. And the goal of such thing is really to hide, going down to simplification. Once you have these kind of objects, which give you, I mean, the most magic stuff for me with the editing context from EOF is really that you do a bunch of stuff, your object, and all you have to do is call save changes, and you magically know what you've done, right? You don't have to worry about what do I have to insert? What did I update? What did I delete? that's a lot of work that you as a developer don't have to do, because that thing is keep track for you, and then that's real simplification. But I remember discussion with Bertrand, who was very worried, and rightfully so, that he always felt that EOF was complex, and it was. Yeah, and I agree with that too.
I do.
But it's really hard, because there's a lot of stuff going on, there are a lot of concepts, and I think we may have simplified enough. I don't know. We always worried about that, but...
No, I think let's dig into that a little bit, because I think it is relevant to components. I think one of the biggest issues with components has to do with communication between components.
Yeah.
And one of the worries that I have with a number of the approaches to communication between components, including the one in Cocoa, is that I worry it's complex. EOF, Core Data, these things particularly so. And I use Rich Hickey's definition of the word complex, etymologically, combining multiple strands, combining multiple concerns. And so if we look at a EOF-backed, and for listeners on the web, you've no reason to know what this is. This is like an archaeological thing.
Yeah, this enterprise object framework.
This is, So imagine a situation where like a JavaScript object that's handed to you will transparently, like when you try to access a particular property, it will like perform fetches as necessary, or perhaps it'll consult a cache in order to retrieve that value. And this object instance that you have, this same instance will be returned in response to other queries which speak to that same identity. So like if you were to ask for, give me all the apples, and then give me all the apples again, you'll get literally the same object instances. And the reason that these objects are inherently complex is that any client of these objects, these supposedly simple data objects, is necessarily a client of the managed object context, which they speak to, and therefore transitively, a client, or at least a dependency, or at least influenced by every single other thing which touches that managed object context, which again, transitively, is any single other thing which touches any single other enterprise object. So I worry that one is, when one is passed like a rich data object as opposed to a dumb data object, a dumb value, one ends up dependent on the behavior of more actors in the system.
Well, they do, but fortunately, most... So let's talk about the relationship of components, and then we'll get back to the business objects.
Sure. How should components communicate in your mind?
Right. So it's funny, because I had a conversation this morning with someone else. So One thing we haven't done right, I believe, in Montage, but we'll fix it, is around the boundaries of components. And so here is a problem. The DOM is shared, right? The DOM managed by each of these components end up into the page. And which is also why the shadow DOM doesn't make too much sense for an app. It may make sense for something like a widget, but it makes absolutely no sense to hide the different part of your own app to each other. It doesn't make sense.
Please elaborate. So let me give like a the naive counter argument in my mind is that in AppKit or UIKit or any other framework, you're going to set up some kind of widget hierarchy, which is ultimately going to turn into an OpenGL draw list. Now that OpenGL draw list is managed behind the scenes for you. You don't ever manipulate it. The system manipulates it, mm-hmm. and potentially multiple components concerns are merged into the same elements in that draw list, but you don't know and you don't care. So why is the DOM any different from that OpenGL draw list?
Well, because first of all, it's indexed, and
I mean, so is the OpenGL draw list.
No, I mean indexed in the sense of Google indexing, right?
Okay.
So.
Okay,
I mean, there are assistive devices that are supposed to, like to the end user, you're building one app. Like,
yeah.
your boundaries are your problem. That's a software organization. It doesn't have to bleed into the end result. So for widgets, you kind of, I mean, there are stuff that it makes sense, right? And sadly, the Shadow DOM doesn't even help as much as it should in terms of sandboxing CSS, which is still a very much a problem. But anyway,
it does with inline styles. Have you looked into that at all?
Yeah, but do you find normal that you have to every time you duplicate the thing, the whole style is going to be duplicated per shadow DOM tree?
The runtime CSS JIT will take care of it for you.
Maybe
that was said sardonically. I don't know if I believe that.
I hope. I don't trust this stuff too much, but I hope he does. I really hope he does. But yes, if you do this and they do, then it's a solution. So one thing that we didn't do right, and let's go to sandboxing, the components are the events.
Mm.
So in Montage, you have a component, and the component loads a template. That template contains other components instantiated in that pieces of the DOM that's going to be brought through, right? It is up to the component to decide whether he wants relationship with the component that are inside this template or not. And this relationship can go from bindings of properties of the owner component to whatever is inside. It could be direct assignation of some of the components to some properties because you need to call API on them, right? Or it could be event listening. One of these three type of relationship, but it's not mandatory. And what's really important is that what's inside that template stays private, right? And so one thing that we had done, and we were kind of phasing it away, there was a template object property on components that basically conveniently lets you as the owner get access to everything that was in your template. But guess what? That stuff was public. And so what people did is, of course, is like, oh, I can poke in that thing, so I'm going to poke in that thing, right? And so you're basically losing encapsulation. So one thing that we should do, that we will do on component themselves, is sandboxing by default the event. So imagine you have two components into each other. And then it happens that both of them have a button which in Montage dispatch an action event when it's being clicked. Today, that event move up the tree following the DOM and following the component tree. And so suddenly the component on top is saying that event coming from that button, but that's not his, is that other button down there. And so we in Montage, we have a way to track events with convention in the names of the handler. So you can do handle or capture plus the identifier plus the type of the button. So you can write something called capture submit action, something like that, right? So if you're writing specific stuff like that, it kind of reduces the chance that you're going to catch someone else's event. But ultimately, if that button exists in the template and it's not exposed to the outside world, his event should never leave the confine of his owner. Never. Right.
What about more complex gesture disambiguations? So, you know, situations where you have buttons inside of contexts where there are panning events. The Maps app is always the best example. Mm-hmm. There's like nine different gestures there interoperating at many levels of the hierarchy. And of course, when you have a map inside of a navigation controller, then the navigation controller has its own thing. So like how, I mean, from my view, the web has like simply not even begun to figure that out. Is there anything?
You're right. Okay. You're right.
So we're still just in that place.
Well, yeah. So guess what we've done? We've implemented the kind of responders.
But responders don't solve it. I mean, that's why we made gesture recognizer.
Well, so.
I mean, responders are deficient in so many ways. Like that's, I mean, we started there on iOS and they failed, and so we moved on.
So the way we've done it is we have what we call composers, which are effectively objects whose role is to aggregate raw events to make sense of them, right? So
okay, sure.
So the, I mean, semantically the same concept as gesture recognizer, and they usually work on behalf of the component. So that way you can.
Okay.
You can say, I need that kind of behavior, so I'm going to instantiate one of these guys to help me. So
can they like depend on each other or like cause each other to fail? I mean, are there relationships between the composers? Because that's really the key insight of the gesture system.
No. They should not know each other.
Well, no, they don't. They shouldn't know each other directly, not by name, but they should know each other indirectly.
Correct, and that's what we have. So we use the
okay, cool.
We use I forgot how we called it. Basically, the XA first responder, right? And so, as you go down the tree, like if you have like two press composers, anything that's down the tree closer to where the target is, and claim the pointer, they're gonna win. And so they ask this guy on top to resign. Like for example, you have a press composer, and inside another press composer. The first one in capture phase, that's something that doesn't exist in Coco.
But it wouldn't solve the problem.
Well, it's been...
capture and bubbling is still insufficient because you don't know when the event comes in. There's a period of ambiguity. So for instance, like a pan gesture recognizer doesn't recognize until you move 10 points.
Right.
And a long press gesture recognizer doesn't recognize until some period. And so like in the capture phase, like neither component can capture.
They don't know yet. That's right.
They don't know yet.
But the bottom one always has a more likely precedence just because of its positioning closer to the target.
That is a sensible default, but there are frequently situations where that's not what you want.
So maybe we didn't solve all the problems, but what we have has been helping quite a bit. When the composers needs, and that's not just composers, like it's just the same API exists on components and they played over.
How do you handle a tap inside of a double tap? Like so you have a like a parent view that has a double tap handler, and you have a child view that has a tap handler. So the child view's tap handler can't recognize until it knows that the parent's double tap handler is going to fail.
Right. I don't remember. We do have the double tap composer, and of course, it needs to know. I mean, it needs time to figure out that there are two tap coming. Right.
This comes up in maps a lot.
Versus the one who would say, "Oh, I'm done." Right. So ultimately, I don't know that we solve this one, but I think what's going to happen is the bottom one is going to say, "I'm doing something," and then the other guy is going to say, "Oh, there's double tap, so I'm going to do that."
So they'll both recognize.
Yeah. What's just there?
No, I would think the double tap would recognize, but not the single tap, because one is a child of the other, right?
Right, but if the double tap is a parent, I mean, is like higher in the hierarchy, then you do have a problem.
The child single tap would recognize, I would expect, and if it you know, claims right. First responder or whatever, like causes all the other events to be delivered to it, then the other danger, of course, and this is another thing the gesture recognizer system had to handle, is that then that second tap. Like that second tap, actually, the most likely thing is that second tap will just trigger the inner child again.
Well, yeah. I don't think we have that. Good question. to try again. I mean, we have examples and tests around that. We haven't done that in a while.
Try to implement maps. That's like that's the case. And then once you get that, do Keynote.
Well, so. It's funny you mentioned that because the most, I mean, besides the Montage Studio itself, the most complex app that we've built was built by 10, 12 people over a year from scratch, replacing an Angular application. And Ray worked on that from the beginning to pretty much the end. And we have, that app has a mapping abstraction framework that allows the app to switch for Google when you're online to leaflets when you're offline because of terms without losing anything, right? It's like on the fly. And so we've basically
way cool
abstracted everything so to treat this engine as such. And so we track all events ourselves, and and one thing that's great about Montage is he has the Coco Differ drawing. And so we found out that just because we have Differ drawing and in our own draw, we imperatively call the Google API, right? Google Map inside Montage app works 50% better than by itself, right? I mean, it just makes sense, right? But
that's awesome.
Yeah.
That's great.
Actually, let's stick to gestures for a second, because I do agree that it's not a soft problem for the web. And Andy, you have a lot of experience in this area, having worked on the Apple stack specifically for this functionality. What are your opinions on what we should do for the web?
So, and Andy, could you explain how the problem was solved with the gesture recognizer?
Yeah. Boy, you know, I prepared there was a 5-minute lightning talk on this topic like last year, and I wish I had it in my head right now because then I could.
Yeah, 5 minutes.
Do it real quick. But the key observation is that there are, so like your composers, there are these gesture recognizers that have independent state machines, mm-hmm. which it sounds like yours do. But a key thing is that there's a possible state, and the possible state is frequently what the gestures are in. Those state machines can have declarative relationships specified between each other. So tap gesture recognizers know on a holistic level, on a system level, without having to know about specific instances, that tap gesture recognizers with lower numbers of taps need to wait for tap gesture recognizers with more taps and so on. And there's sort of like there's an API where you can describe these kinds of things. So you have situations where, like one of the ones that's really juicy is if you go to the Mail app on your phone, and you scroll vertically at the left edge of the screen, then you'll start scrolling the UI vertically. If you scroll horizontally at the left edge of the screen, you'll start to navigate back. If you scroll at like 45 degrees, there's a period where the system doesn't know and can't know which thing you're doing. And a naive implementation of this, which I see all the time, nevertheless scrolls the interior content until it knows that, oh no, we're navigating back, and so now like we'll hand off. But you don't want to do that. So instead, the system needs to be flexible enough that it can like take that slack and like just absorb it for a little bit, and then like pick up and start calculating deltas from the point of hysteresis being passed. So there's like a declarative web of state machines, basically.
So they all find each other. So because that's important, right? Like from a code cleanliness structure standpoint, you don't want to because like different UVs have gesture recognizer to kind of like make connections. Yeah. So they find each other.
They don't go rooting right. around in each other's like that. No, they implement methods. It's like, hey, given this other kind of gesture recognizer with these other kinds of like parameters, right. Should it wait for you or not? Or like, should your recognition cause it to be unrecognizable and so on and so forth? And then there's another piece that we alluded to earlier where there's sort of there's holistic tracking and resolution of these state machines, which also takes into account sort of the reset transition is really critical. You don't want that second tap to be like in the situation where you have the single tap gesture recognizer inside of the double tap gesture recognizer's hierarchy. You don't want that second tap to be like reconsidered for the first gesture recognizer again, even though it's a new event. Like it has to wait until all the relevant gestures have finished, and then we can reset and like reconsider.
So do the gesture recognizer buffer kind of like hijack the events and they don't go anywhere until they know, and then replay the whole thing and kind of like rewrite history, or do
it's
they?
It's gesture recognizer specific, so
right.
It depends, like whatever's going to create the best user experience, you know.
Right, because I mean that's something we kind of experimented with, and we backtrack because like we have an event manager inside Montage, and he has the benefit of allowing like event delegation. So the event manager reason like right away for anything that starts the cycle, like mouse down, touch starts, key down, right? And then we have an API that lets the event manager tell the component like you're about to be interacted with for the first time. And so at the last moment, only when we know something's going to happen. And so that's the method where you install your actually true DOM event listeners. So that way, I mean, that's one of the bane of large web application is like, you have to put the event like right away, otherwise you're going to lose stuff, right? And it just takes time for this ridiculous for nothing, right? Where in Cocoa it's distributed on the fly, you don't even have to do that. But anyway, so I try.
I wonder if you could get away with it. So this is maybe a point of naivete on my part. Could you just install the event listeners at the document level?
Of course.
And like just handle all the event handling?
That's what we
like,
do.
All the issues? Okay, great.
That's what we do. And so because of that, we have that kind of ability to, between the user, the event actually happens, and when we distribute it to our components or just a recognizer, we can lie and say, oh, we can buffer them, we can, and stuff like that. And so we have a translate composer that will allow you to, like, it doesn't do the moving, but it will tell you how much you should move if you want to do a drag, for example. And we track, if you turn on that capability, which the Translate Composer does on Event Manager, I think we track the past 16 events, like all the time to exactly know and so if you want this, if a composer need that to make decisions, you turn that on and you have that buffer of the past 16 events, which is pretty enough to make decisions, but it's painful. I agree with you.
Yeah, yeah.
I have an observation though. Isn't it a gesture that is confusing to implement a bad idea from a UX standpoint in the first place?
I mean, maps are pretty intuitive, and so is like the Photos app with like pinch to zoom thing. But the state machine in the
but that's not there, there's no comp- they, I mean. There's mass to involve a pinch zoom, right? But there's no confusion about what you're gonna do. Like imagine.
I mean in the iPad app, when the iPad launched,
yeah.
The iPad app had like these stacks of photos,
yes.
In a scrollable view. Yeah. You could tap on the stack of photos and it would. Boom, you could scroll the view. You could press and hold and then drag around and rearrange the photos. And you could like pinch open the photos, and that.
I still have issues
with
that.
That disambiguation was crazy without gestures, and then it was re-implemented with gestures, and it was really friendly. And the same with maps.
Right. Still, I wonder if there's not some UX smell. Like if the interaction is so hard to pull off.
Yeah, I get that.
Maybe there is some UX smell that should be backed off of that kind of idea, right? Because if it's confusing for the developer to code, so maybe sometimes it's intuitive for the user, but. But usually, if you think about it, like there is a real confusion somewhere.
So we're facing something similar at work, where we have a functionality that is a long press with your mouse, a long click with your mouse, and
that is super non-idiomatic.
I would put a tooltip. Do you have a cramp?
Right, and. Basically, there's no way to know unless you show the user a tutorial. And in my opinion, if you show the user a tutorial, you failed, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I definitely have to agree that gesture has the challenge of discoverability. We've been thinking a lot about that.
Yeah, totally. Well, I mean, long press in general is an anti-pattern. I mean, and
Apple
tries to avoid it. Like, long press is a cheap force touch. Like force touch is what long press wants to be.
It's a pause man's force touch. Yeah,
I agree. Definitely.
So So while I'm pretty happy with the way that the gesture system worked out, that's one of the only APIs in UIKit that like years later I still fully support that API. But one thing about it that I don't like is it's very object-y, it's very stateful. And so I've been trying to help like some of the React folks like figure out how to merge it into that world, which I much prefer to the world I grew up on. And it's not clear how to adapt that solution to React yet. Some folks are trying, but no one succeeded yet.
So what do you prefer of that stack?
It's not the stack that I prefer. Do we want to get into
what aspect of it?
I don't know. I mean, yeah, we can certainly get into in this particular holy war. Yeah. But
I'm curious.
Or perhaps just what are some of the good qualities that you look for in a framework, React included, for the web?
Mm-hmm. I don't like frameworks. I don't want to use a framework. I want to use a library. I mean, like, that's one of the key things, right? Like, what I want is linear control flow. What I want is values, not objects. What I want is composition with functions, not with exotic operators. React has Elm. Elm is simple in a Hickean sense, in a way that's very beautiful, and which solves so many of the problems I've faced over the many, many years wrestling with imperative stateful Cocoa products.
I am not familiar at all with Elm. It's a language, right?
Oh, yeah, it's sort of like an academic basis of a lot of the React ideas. It's sort of Haskell derivative. You should look at it, actually. It's trying to solve a lot of the same problems that the Montage is solving, and it's really interesting.
But you say it's a programming language.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I have a maybe controversial stand that the web's programmers are clearly not coming from his languages.
I agree. I'm not saying like you should pay attention to Elm like the language. Like that's not the point. The point is the ideas. And React, you know, React is based on a lot of the ideas, as are various other projects, you know. And I say the same thing, actually. I think it's a really important message for the iOS developers. So, you know, I work with all these native developers also, and they can't hear the ideas coming from the JavaScript world because they see, like, the example code, and it's written in JavaScript, and they're just like, shut down. And similarly, like, we have to be able to look at Elm, which is like a Haskell derivative, and look at those ideas and treat them earnestly and then bring them back to our work.
How do you see... such a language feature blending or influencing or helping solving concepts that are higher, that have nothing to do with the language itself, patterns, like components, UI, all of these have nothing to do with the languages itself that's around.
That's the best part. The best part is that you can ignore the language part and still learn a lot.
Yeah, right. I agree with that, but I'm not sure. Like, I mean, sometimes there are features in languages that open up new ways of thinking, mm-hmm.
Totally.
That are successful, right? I mean, it happens. I think the dynamic nature of Objective-C with the runtime has a lot to do with some of the way that things were done, but in my experience, it's been fairly rare. And I don't know that language at all. So to understand what aspect specifically of it might influence stuff that are not language dependent.
I don't really think Elm's language choices are all that important, really, like in terms of its ideas. You know, Evan would disagree. It's creative. You know, he would say all kinds of things. He would say, you know, it has a focus on safety. It can make all kinds of guarantees that JavaScript could never possibly make.
Right.
But like, you know, these stories, like, you know, why Haskell people like Haskell, and like those are lessons that we can take from that language. But for Elm in particular, it's the design patterns that are interesting and which through React have influenced so many things and Redux.
So one of the last discussion points that I had in mind was talking about working with designers. I think Benoit briefly touched upon this in the beginning of the show, where one of the goals of his framework is to make it easier for engineers and designers to collaborate. Andy, I was wondering if you can talk a little bit about your experiences managing and working with both designers and engineers on components. What are some of the challenges, and what are potentially some of the best practices that you've encountered?
I heard a request for a response there. So sure, yeah. For me, some of the most exciting things that have happened in technology have been the result of deep collaborations between designers and engineers. In particular, the things that neither person could have seen themselves. I'm really excited by continuous interfaces that are not just like we're going to move from screen A to screen B, through discrete gestures, through a tap, but rather we're going to move fluidly in the continuum of states between A and B using a continuous gesture. That kind of stuff is stuff that a designer can't design generally because the tools don't exist, and it's stuff that an engineer can't think up, so it requires these deep collaborations. I've spent a lot of time and energy trying to make that kind of thing happen. I did that a lot at Apple. And outside of Apple, you know, there's a dearth of tools. There's a serious dearth of tools. There's a lot of prototyping tools that are coming up. It's a big thing now. Most of them are not what I want. It's better than nothing. What advice do I have? You gotta get people sitting next to each other. You gotta get the designers to be willing to talk a little bit of code. You gotta get the engineers to understand the designers. It's a complex space, and it's in a bad place right now. It's better than it's ever been.
I definitely agree. I think sitting together makes a huge difference, and that's something that we do at work. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the whole thing is a mess, and it's a mess across stack. I mean, no one has. I mean, it's bad everywhere, and the place where it's probably the least worst is probably the web, ironically. But the, I mean, like Ray mentioned, and I said before, one of the goal of Montage, and especially of Montage Studio, is to build the first interaction design tool that's actually real code and real shipping software. Basically,
well, there's a few of those. I mean, there's Fuse, like there's Unity.
Yes, but it's not an app platform. Yes, there's Unity.
Fuse is.
No, I mean, not really. It was designed for games and 3D initially. They've extended a bit, right?
Okay.
But you're right. It's one of. I mean, there were two before. Flash was one, and Silverlight was another one, right?
Fair enough. Flash was great. Oh my gosh! Actually, let's just talk about that for a second. It feels like we moved backwards. You know, the rubber banding of the scroll views for iOS and the inertial deceleration.
Yeah.
That was Macromedia Director. Done by the one and only Boss Ording. And like that tool
is gone.
That's right. That class of tools is gone.
And so our goal is to bring it back, but for the web. And
cool.
And that's, I mean, obviously not easy, but and we're not done yet, and I would like to mention Keith. Keith Oles, who would have been there if he didn't die like a month ago, he joined us. So Keith was an amazing guy. He designed the whole NextStep OS, but the one thing that's amazing, so that's just like a great achievement by itself, but what's more impressive is how he did it. He built with other colleagues help, but he built nonetheless an app called Pixelist, which was kind of a Photoshop at the time. So that was like 1980 something, right? So he could do his work as a designer on NextStep, which had graphics capabilities that did not exist anywhere else, right? And so people who have both the design capabilities that Keith has and the engineering, like being dangerous enough to actually pull off this kind of stuff, are fairly rare. I mean, statistically speaking. And so when NextStep was done, Keith left a bit after, and he focused his entire career working on TV UI. So he was the lead designer at web TV. Then he was the lead guy at Vudu, and then at Fanhattan, which became Fan TV, which I think was the best discovery UI of content that I've ever seen. And so I managed to lure him at Montage Studio because he saw the promise of that, which is building the tools that he missed for himself, because all that he did after Next was entirely web. And it was the opportunity to right that wrong and build the stuff that he wanted to have. And so basically a cloud-based studio, which is what we have, where you have ever-growing and community-driven piece of content that you don't have to go and look at the code to use. That they will be into some platforms. You can drag and drop them. There's no code generation. And you just assemble them. And I mean, that's where the montage world come from. And recompose your UI with building blocks that you can just data bind, track events, simple stuff that everybody knows how to do, and basically do your app. But with the massive difference that underneath that, which is what a lot of interaction design tools do, is actually a real software platform that's optimized to work great on HTML5 stacks from mobile to desktops, right? And wearables. And that is the fundamental piece. Like, if you manage to bridge that gap that exists between the tools that designers use today and the developer, that platform is going to massively leap ahead of anything else, including the native one, assuming you deliver the good, right? And so that's and what's really sad is you,
amen,
you look at the space and all of these startups you mentioned, you're absolutely right, they are more than they ever was. But they're all reproducing the exact same broken pattern, which is, I'm going to build a better tool for designers that goes nowhere after that, right? And so you end up with designers like doing this great stuff, basically building an interactive movie, for better lack of terms, and then you show that to the developer on your side, and he's going to try to reproduce this in the stack is chose, whether it's .NET, Java, Android, or web, right? And that's just iteration one. And we all know, especially for working in Apple, that great software has come out of like a massive amount of iteration, because that's what it takes to own the problem and that collaboration between stuff. And designers are not the only creative guys. I can guarantee you that a designer gives something to a developer, he's going to have another idea to improve, he's going to improve it. And so at the end of his iteration, he has something that's different. He did not just execute what the designer did. And so guess what? The designer has to recreate that idea in his own world so he can iterate on that himself, and so on and so forth. I mean, it's such a massive loss of time.
It's maddening. It's absolutely infuriating to watch this happen constantly. I can't agree more with everything you're saying.
It is horrible. It is horrible. My goal, and I think I think we all agree that it's worthwhile to attempt. But ironically, it's a software problem. First, you have to build a software stack that will lead you down the path so you can build that tool. You will never solve that by starting from the design tool angle, and that's where everybody else who is doing it today is starting from. And so they will end up in the exact same place with more or less better tools, right? So it's funny, you mentioned the one thing we've done in the studio, because it's web, you can connect devices or other browser windows to your working station. And as you instantiate objects, as you change their properties, as you create bindings, as you add event listeners, we inject the same thing in every app, client instance app connected to it in real time. And so you can connect different devices of different shape, different input mode, and to build something responsive, all you have to do is just like glance around, like play with them as you do the work, make sure it's doing what you expect, right? And that's and in real time, because it's all interpreted, of course, you can do this to a point. I mean, if you change JavaScript code in a way that's incompatible with what was there, you probably need to reload sometimes, right? But the more building blocks you have, the more you push that back, because you have these objects pre-made that you just instantiate, you don't configure them, you delete them, and that brings a level of instant feedback of what you're designing or thinking through that no native platform can ever do. Because, I mean, you can tweak native objects remotely. Sure, you could. But you're never going to add dynamically new code to the app that's running, unless Apple decide to add NS bundles to...
You can check out displayscript.org for some interesting work in this domain. But, I mean, you're right. It's certainly...
On which platform?
All platforms, but it's certainly a longer road.
It's harder.
It is. You know, I mean, so I definitely take your point about it being a software problem. It's an interesting argument that really, you know, it needs to be shippable. I guess a flip side of that that's interesting to me is that I think it's also primarily a design problem. Mm-hmm. I think we have no idea how to build a tool that is for making dynamic interfaces. And here's where we get into research land. You know, it's like my primary hat these days is research hat. And I think no one has come even in the same ballpark. Mm-hmm. And the stuff that's close is nothing like production. It's nowhere near production. So it'll be interesting to see this stuff play out both on the software stack side as you're describing and also in the design research side.
You need both because, like you said, there's no, I mean, responsive apps are new in general. It's a new thing. No native platform knows how to do that except Windows. And they are not, I mean, tools always follows the raw capabilities, right?
Yeah.
And so it's so recent that there's no good way of, I mean, it's still an open field, very, very much so with, yeah.
No, that's true. And I mean, and we can't even do response. Like, I wasn't even talking about response. Like, to me, that's like trivial. Like, oh, it works at different sizes. Like, what? Like, that is such a tiny part of the problem. I'm talking about dynamic interfaces in a broad sense. Dynamic in the sense.
You mean that change themselves as you use the app?
It behaves and responds.
Yeah, you mean like, for example, the background of your app changing because the sun is sitting there. I mean, I'm simplifying, but
I mean that as you interact with the interface, it changes in dynamic and continuous ways.
Yeah.
I mean, you move your finger on the screen and the elements dance and respond, you know, in the way that they do.
Right.
Scrolling is the simplest possible example, but there's a million other things that we've barely even explored because our tools are so bereft.
You're right. Yeah.
I think that's actually a pretty interesting note. That there are a million different things, whether it's component related or whether it's the many other elements that we're missing for web technologies. I think we definitely probably need another show or two to explore all the different possibilities. Today we talked about components, we talked about encapsulation, we talked about gestures, we talked about tooling, we talked about working with designers, and I think we barely just scratched the surface of how hard it is to build good, reusable, solid components. How hard is it to do it with the web API? And we barely scratched the surface with the amount of knowledge that you guys have, both on the website as well as the native side. So what I recommend is let's wrap up today and potentially find another time where we can regroup and talk about some other interesting topics. So how would people find you on the web, Benoit?
That's a good question. I tend to be pretty bad.
Maybe Twitter?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter, absolutely. I don't write nowhere near as much as I wish I could. I should. I need to get better at that. That's going to be my 2017 resolution. It's coming up.
Yeah, and your Twitter handle is?
Benoit Marchant, one word. And yeah, that's a good way to ping me and otherwise email. I mean, you can ping me on LinkedIn, of course. I'm there.
Sure. And Andy, how will people find you on the web and follow all the interesting talks and writings that you do?
Yeah, the most frequent thing is Twitter. Andy_Matuschak, MATUSCHAK. AndyMatuschak.org is my website. I do write there occasionally, but not so often anymore. If you want to keep up on my research, particularly the learning research of my group, KLR for Khan Long-Term Research, klr.tumblr.com. You can see sort of a working journal of what we're up to.
Great, great. And thank everyone for joining us for today's episode.
Thank you.
You can find the Modern Web on Twitter at modernweb_ and on the web at modern-web.org. Thanks again, and we will see you and everybody else in the next episode. Shout it, yeah!